Hello, my name is Chip Ling, and you are listening to Total EM. We are back again with the one, the only, Mike Sharma to talk about ATLS. As always, Mike, how are you doing?
You know, I'm pretty sure there are a lot of Mike Sharmas out there. I get emails from this other guy, Mike Sharma, in California. I think he owns like a karate dojo. So, other Mike Sharma, if you're out there listening, hey, what's going on? But thanks, Chip, for assuming I'm the one and only. There are many of us.
There is actually a Chip Lang out there too.
Oh wow!
That is listening to this, but he's like with EA, and he's one of their top people. So I almost want to be able to be like, yes, please give me his money.
Wait, EA like Electronic Arts, like the video games?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay, yeah, cool. So,
I don't know if he's still with it because I haven't like looked this guy up in a couple of years, but he is out there.
You know, he's probably, if he's in like video games, he's probably out in California. I wonder if the other Mike Sharma and the other Chip Lang hang out.
Oh my gosh, wouldn't that be crazy?
All right, we probably should stop considering this parallel universe Mike and Chip.
All right, but we should introduce ourselves though, right? So I'll let you go first, Mike.
Okay, well, my name is Mike Sharma. I'm a practicing emergency medicine PA and a passionate medical educator. I live and work in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, been full-time in emergency medicine for the past 6+ years and been a PA for a little bit over 10 years. My previous experience to prior to emergency medicine was with the U.S. military. So I was an Army PA for 4 years, including one deployment to Afghanistan where I worked as a trauma team leader. So trauma became something I needed to know very well, very early. And it's a pleasure to talk with Chip about these topics today.
All right. And I'm Chip Lang. I run the Total EM podcast, which stands for Tools of the Trade in Academic Learning in Emergency Medicine, but no one ever remembers that. And that's totally fine. And I also love to be in education and to teach. I teach a variety of things, including point of care ultrasound, like we always like to talk about with Practical POCUS. But also, I do work in emergency medicine as a PA in a rural part of Missouri. And I really enjoy it, though. I think it's something that is something that we always need. And trauma is one of those subjects and one of those topics that we come across all the time. But some of us don't see it that often, and so we need classes to help us stay up to date, which is what all of this is about with the ATLS series, right, Mike?
Yeah, and you know, you talk about your background in ultrasound. We are going to talk a lot about the mostly pros and a few rare cons of ultrasound and other detection of significant injury in the abdomen and pelvis today.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think there's very few cons with this, but it's worth remembering that there is not always a perfect world when this comes up, right? So let's talk a little bit about what we're actually going to talk about today, and that is abdominal trauma. So this is one of the very common things that we're going to see and learn about with ATLS. It's kind of one of the bread and butter subjects, right? But it's something that also can be a bit tricky because you can still miss some very important injuries even with appropriate imaging like CT. It's not perfect. And I learned this a lot when I was doing a separate podcast with pediatric abdominal trauma and realizing that hollow viscous injuries can sometimes be missed. But I don't want to get too far ahead of things here, but I want Mike to go ahead and lead us off with talking about this chapter, chapter 5.
Yeah, I think there's some great low-cost, high-yield ways to detect those more insidious injuries, and we'll hit that for sure. Let's start off with just a general overview here. And like we've been doing for the rest of the ATLS chapters, we are really going to focus on the red text. Again, our idea here is to prepare our listeners for passing the ATLS test, and then number two, doing well in taking care of trauma patients in the real world. So the first red text here, the assessment of circulation during the primary survey includes early evaluation for possible intra-abdominal and or pelvic hemorrhage in patients who have sustained blunt trauma. And so two kind of aspects there. You're trying to early on assess the hemodynamic stability of this patient's, because if you have someone who is hemodynamically stable for now, then okay, we have some time to do some diagnostics and try a few things. If someone rolls into your ER and they are from the jump hemodynamically unstable, and there's different ways to assess that, they need to go to the operating room right away, and we kind of skip over some of those other things we might order in a stable patient. So that's one. Number two, I think, is having an appreciation for what kind of injuries can result in, can cause abdominal and pelvic trauma. And so I talked in the last podcast about the chin to umbilicus rule that I used in thoracic trauma. If you've got a wound between your chin and your belly button, I'm worried that something in the thoracic box has been injured here. A similar rule exists for the abdomen. If you're injured anywhere from the nipple to the perineum, then I've got to be worried about how, hey, could something have tracked north or south and gotten into the abdomen and pelvis?
And this is so important because if you miss abdominal or pelvic injuries, this will have a high risk of complications and can very easily lead to a preventable death. So we want to make sure that any injuries to the trunk, we are thinking about not only the thoracic trauma like we talked about with the last podcast, but also abdominal and pelvic trauma.
And what's tricky about this is that, again, going right off the red text is, you can hold a lot of blood in your abdomen. You can hold a lot of blood in your retroperitoneum as well. It's something that we didn't have in the thorax to consider. We have this entire space, this fatty occupied space in the back of our abdomen and pelvis here that can hold a lot of blood. And so you don't have to have distension. You don't have to have peritonitis. You don't have to have obvious bruising to the outside to have a lot of nasty stuff happening in the abdomen and pelvis.
And let's talk a little bit more about this anatomy side of this. So with the retroperitoneal space, again, this is a spot that is easy to miss injuries, especially on just our physical exam alone, because a lot of times they aren't going to have signs or symptoms of such as peritonitis. However, a very interesting thing that Mike found with a JAMA article regarding peritonitis is that it is accurate with 97% of the time, if someone has peritonitis, that they will have something abnormal on their laparotomy. So this is one of those things where if someone has peritonitis, then we really need to consider that they have something very serious going on. And 45% of them have sustained an injury to an extra abdominal region as well. But Mike, I have an important question for you on this.
Uh-oh. Okay.
What is peritonitis?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if we think about what we're worried about here in abdominal trauma, I'm worried about something bleeding or maybe a hollow viscous organ like an intestine leaking intestinal contents, poop basically, into the abdominal cavity. And so what's that going to lead to? Well, either, you know, blood loss and hemodynamic instability, or we're going to have sepsis infection with the viscous contents leaking out here. And so either one of those things, blood or intestinal contents, can cause an irritation of the internal lining of the abdomen. And so that irritation, right, that itis of the peritoneal lining is your peritonitis. So how do you find that? Well, we all know about tenderness as being a, you know, a sign of injury here. But with peritonitis, there's so many different ways to detect that. And so one classic way is to look for rebound tenderness, where you push down gently on someone and you suddenly release the pressure and that kind of elastic rebounding of the abdominal wall. If that causes significant pain to the patient, well, that can be concerning for peritonitis. And I've seen other ways to do this. I use things like the Rovsing sign, where I push on the left lower quadrant and I ask the patient, do you feel pain in the right lower quadrant? So that's one of the things I use for appendicitis to kind of help my diagnostic accuracy here on my physical exam. But that's a way. The reverse Rovsing, I'm pushing on the right and asking for pain on the left. I could also do a heel tap test where I'll smack the patient's heel and generate kind of like an energy wave into the abdomen. And that jiggling, I call it jiggling with the patients because it's funny, you know? So I say, hey, well, me jiggling your abdominal wall, you having a lot of pain with me hitting your heel and I just jiggled you, that caused pain. I'm worried about something irritating inside the abdominal wall here. Kids will often do a jump test. We'll have the kids stand up. It's kind of fun. Okay, hey, show me how high you can jump 3 times in a row. And that jumping up and down also jiggles their belly. And I have to explain to the parents now, hey, what I did there was actually kind of a scientific test. And it makes me more or less concerned about your son or daughter having something important going on there. So peritonitis, a very ominous finding, not just necessarily in the setting of medical abdominal and pelvic issues, but also much more so, I feel like, for abdominal and pelvic trauma.
One other kind of important point with this is that there are other ways to assess this too. And one of my favorites is to ask about the ride there. So whether they come by their own vehicle or they come by ambulance, I ask them like, hey, how was the ride here? And like, oh, it was awful. Okay, well, what made it awful? Every single bump hurt. Okay, well, that's another sign of peritoneal irritation. Mike is onto something when he says that it might even be better for trauma. And I have talked to surgeons about this in the past. And when they talk about patients who are staying for like an observation or admission and to an inpatient basis, maybe they had some more mild trauma, but it was worth getting them into the hospital to observe them for a longer period of time. And now they're starting to develop signs of peritonitis. There are quite a few surgeons who will just take that as is and not necessarily take them back to, say, CT to evaluate further, but just say, hey, this person's obviously getting worse. Peritonitis is bad. It's just time to open them up and look and see what's going on inside.
I think it's very worthwhile. We'll talk later on about how CT can miss stuff. And so sometimes this is where your physical exam, as they talk about, you know, the omnipresent they, always watching our work here, they say that history and physical exam get you 70, 80, 90% towards your diagnosis here. So if I'm seeing on serial abdominal exam more and more ominous findings, and I know that CT scan can be falsely negative for stuff, and I know this person had abdominal trauma so bad that I'm keeping them in the hospital for a day, hey, maybe you just go ahead and take them to surgery instead of trying to do another test, exposing them to radiation, things like that.
Let's talk about some of the mechanisms then, since we're kind of like naturally moving into that part. So one of the big ones we think about is like blunt trauma, right? We see blunt trauma a lot. And one of the big things that's in red text, and I think it's really important to remember here, is that airbag deployment does not preclude abdominal injury. While airbags are meant to be helpful, they aren't foolproof. So if you have someone who is complaining of severe abdominal pain, especially like Mike says, they're getting worse and worse, then I'm still worried about them, even if they had, you know, multiple airbags that went off. They had their front end bags, their curtain airbags, everything's going off, but they can still have some serious trauma going on. So don't let airbags reassure you.
And that's also important in the setting of people with protuberant bellies. Maybe they've just taken advantage too many times at the Grandy's buffet here, or maybe they're pregnant, but that seatbelt sometimes does not lie right where it should when you've got a lot of mass in the way. And so just because the airbag did or not deploy doesn't mean that they can't have trauma applied in not good ways to that abdomen.
Let's take another important one, penetrating trauma. So there are high and low velocity or high and low energy type of injuries. So stabbing is a low injury event where you have something where basically it's only the amount of force that can be applied that's causing the trauma. And so that's going to cause like a tearing and lacerating type of injury, which can still be very severe, especially when you have injuries to the box, because I mean, you can have some major trauma to some relatively superficial structures. It does not take much depth with a knife to cause some serious problems. Now, high energy wounds, including gunshot wounds, there's a lot more of a transfer of kinetic energy. And so what happens here is that they cause some increased damage because of this effect of cavitation. And so the way to think about this for a moment is that when a projectile, such as a firearm being discharged, and so a round is going into the body, when that bullet makes impact, it is pushing things out of the way in the process. And what happens is you get this like bowing effect inside of the body, and it leaves a temporary cavity that occurs. And then that all closes back up. Well, just because everything closed back up doesn't mean it's okay. Like with the laceration, usually the immediate tissue is your concern. But with the high energy wounds, you have something where now it has caused a lot of displacement of tissue and a lot of transfer of energy throughout those tissues. So you can get a lot of damage inside that really doesn't show up. And you see this worse, just something to know about. Full Metal Jacket, there's a reason why it is required and used through the Geneva Convention, and that's because it tends to cause less of this injury, although it can still happen very badly. But hollow points are known for their ability to cause even more displacement and more cavitation.
Yeah, some of these rounds are designed to make big holes in people, but how does that happen with the same size round? It's because of the engineering of the round to cause increased cavitation, tumbling, things like that. Something else important to talk about is the kind of projectile. So, you know, a 5.56 millimeter round from M16 or AR-15 is going to deliver energy differently than a shotgun. You know, so a rifle is designed to travel long distances at high accuracy. A shotgun is kind of made for more in-close, dirty work here. So it's important. Okay, you got a gunshot wound patient. Well, what kind of a weapon was it? How far away from the person was the firearm here? Something that's, I think, interesting to note is that when you have a shotgun wound, your likelihood of major injuries to the viscera decrease outside of that 3 meter or 10 foot range. And so if we know this or some of those way far away from the shotgun, we can kind of like breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief, but at the same time be looking for stuff.
So hunting injuries, this is actually something very common, and we're about into hunting season. Depending on when exactly this podcast comes out, it may already be hunting season. But with shotguns, with birdshot, I see this happen with relative frequency, and very often they have minimal to no significant injuries, unless, of course, it hits their face, and that's kind of a whole separate beast there. But let's say it hits the trunk, like we're talking about here. The shotgun blast with birdshot, A, it's already very small projectiles, and usually they're being shot at a farther distance. And so while it will cause a whole lot of BBs all over the body, and it's going to light up really pretty on CT, they usually do not get that deep into the tissues, especially when we're talking about bigger people and heavier clothing, because usually it's wintertime when this occurs. They usually don't have that bad of trauma. But when you have someone who gets hit with, say, buckshot, it's a totally different story. You have much larger rounds that are able to travel at a higher velocity and penetrate a little bit deeper down. So all those factors play a role when we start talking about weapons that fire multiple projectiles.
One more mechanism to discuss here is blast injuries, and we dealt with that a lot in the military. People getting blown up by these IEDs, whether they were walking along, dismounted and stepping on something, or inside of a vehicle, enclosed in a small space and being exposed to an explosion. That enclosure sometimes can kind of amplify things, so to speak, because that energy reverberates around. And something that's mentioned in the ATLS manual is that, be systematic in your approach here, but when you hear about a blast injury, be thinking about these overpressure injuries. It's just another way that energy can impact the body, like the cavitation, but be somewhat hidden with respect to when you're looking at the patient and kind of visually inspecting them. Knowing that mechanism of blast injury, especially for someone in an enclosed space, can suggest hidden things that we really need to do serial exams on and be more worried for hidden things.
There is also a podcast that I have that goes into a lot more detail, which we'll link in the show notes as well, because blast injuries are a very separate beast, as Mike is alluding to. And even that podcast is meant to be brief, but it explains more about overpressure, underpressure scenarios and what occurs and why there are different stages of trauma with blasts. It's a rather complex subject, but it's very important to understand at least the basics, because even in the civilian world, you can run into blast injuries.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about most recently, I believe, kind of the Boston Marathon bomb, and we had big explosions there. That's the biggest one that I can think of in my memory. Is there anything else, Chip, that jumps out at you?
The most recent, probably big one that people might recall, depending on how soon they're listening to this podcast, is the rather large explosion that occurred in Beirut. But that's actually why I had the podcast on blast injuries with the timing that it was.
Oh my gosh, you're right. The port explosion. I totally forgot about that. There were some amazing videos coming out of that.
Yeah, that was kind of a big one. I don't know how you forgot that one, Mike.
I guess I was thinking more like, continental United States, that sort of a thing.
All right, we'll go with that. We'll go with that.
Sure.
So assessment and management here. Another big red text thing that we need to talk about. In hypotensive patients, the goal is to rapidly identify an abdominal or pelvic injury and determine whether it is the cause of hypotension. I mean, that's going to be true no matter what the origin is. We want to know that if someone is hypotensive, where the hell is this injury? And what can we do to fix this as rapidly as possible? Now, given if someone has an abdominal or pelvic injury, in most cases, and especially when you're in a rural or remote setting, you may not have the means to treat this immediately, which is why you want to identify it and get them to the appropriate place. That rapid disposition and transfer once the patient is stabilized is key. but this is something that I feel like is in some ways a given, but it's worth remembering that we want to make sure that if patients are hypotensive, that we think about the abdomen and pelvis as a potential cause.
So I want to talk this through with you, Chip. You know, let's say you get somebody in your ER and you know, you're in Missouri, you're not at like a level one trauma center or anything like that. I know with your passion for point of care ultrasound, you know, let's say you get someone with abdominal trauma, kind of soft vital signs here. I'm guessing you're very early going to do some sort of a FAST exam or an EFAST exam. If you see fluid in the abdomen, fluid in the pelvis here, are you just immediately working on shipping that person to the trauma center, or are you doing further diagnostic imaging there?
If they have free fluid on exam, and if I don't have a surgeon who can take them, which in my setting, not, there's nothing else I can really do for this patient other than the initial stabilization. So I'm going to stabilize them appropriately, but I'm going to transfer. I'm going to work on the disposition because I've already identified the cause. What the other part I think is okay, what all is needed with the stabilization? And you mentioned some kind of soft vital signs. If you recall back to our shock podcast, I'm going to think about, you know, what's their shock index and how do they actually appear? Do they need to start a massive transfusion protocol, or is this someone who is probably stable enough where they may not need it at this point?
Yeah, I think they don't really talk about things like MTP or TXA a lot in this chapter, but they've already talked about it in previous chapters here. So I think this chapter is more focusing on kind of detecting these somewhat, you know, hidden or unusual kinds of peritoneal injuries.
So here's the other part with this, another red text part. Hemodynamically normal patients without signs of peritonitis may undergo a more detailed evaluation to determine the presence of injuries that can cause delayed morbidity and mortality. So essentially that's going back to what we're talking about. So if we have negative findings by our exam and our initial testing, yeah, we could probably go into a more detailed exam, assuming that we don't already have something that creates a new disposition anyway. So if this was going to make the difference of someone being discharged home versus someone being transferred, then yes, I'm probably going to go ahead and still get those tests up until the point where either I feel comfortable with having ruled out life threats, they're feeling much better, they're ready to go home, versus, hey, I found something new. And by observing them a little bit longer, maybe there have been some clinical changes.
Yeah, I think that the English translation of that red text is that you have time to kind of stay in place, so to speak. You have time to do serial abdominal exams, to do these tests that may require IV and maybe even oral contrast. We'll talk about, you know, double and triple contrast studies later on. But we have time when the hemodynamics and the exam suggest a more benign process going on. So speaking of physical exam and doing that more intensive exam here, this chapter is very interesting with regards to how it talks about the physical exam here. You know, and so they talk about in the ATLS chapter about inspecting first, which makes sense. You're looking for, you know, things outside of the abdominal cavity that should usually be inside of the abdominal cavity. We're looking for bruising. We're looking for lacerations. We're looking for anything that's, you know, looks out of the ordinary there. Fine. Inspection first. Okay.
Hold on, Mike.
Yes.
Are we about to talk about like the stuff I learned in PA school about like inspect, auscultate, percuss, and palpate?
Yeah. I mean, this is like really throwback stuff. I wanted to put on bell bottoms and, you know, light some incense on fire when I was reading this stuff.
So you mean that that stuff actually matters? I can't just put everyone into a CT and that figures everything out for me?
I mean, generally it does, but I think it's going to do these things first, you know, just to say you did them.
All right. Sorry. I realized where we're going with this. I was like, holy crap, the four things of physical exam that they always talk about.
Like medicine and stuff.
Yeah. So inspect, and I already ruined it, but auscultate's the next part, right?
Yeah, auscultate. And, you know, I'm frankly a little down the mouth on auscultation. You know, I mean, they admit in the chapter the presence or absence of bowel sounds does not necessarily correlate with injury. So it's like, okay, well then why is it so necessary to do that if it's not sensitive or specific? So, okay, you know, auscultate, you know, if you think it's going to be very helpful, honestly, but I think you can skip right ahead to percussion. And that ties in great with the peritonitis discussion we had earlier. So percussion ties back into our initial conversation on peritonitis and peritoneal signs. And so I think that this is kind of a very nice thing from the American College of Surgeons is that if you percuss and you get rebound tenderness or pain with percussion in an area, I mean, think about how you're just kind of like knock, knock, knocking on that abdomen. It's very light percussion. And if that right away generates, very spasmodic pain in the patient, hey, maybe that's your clue that something bad is going on. And maybe you forgo the deep palpation of that same spot just because you're supposed to do shallow and deep palpation of the abdomen. If you already know this person is really uncomfortable here, you don't have to seek additional evidence of irritation. You've already got your evidence here. You're already worried about something bleeding or otherwise leaking out of a viscous organ into the abdominal cavity here. And something else that's, very nice on the part of the American College of Surgeons here. Hey, after you're done doing that exam, cover the patient up. Don't let them sit and be naked there. Get some warm blankets, depending on how cold they are. Maybe we're even doing things like a bear hugger or other things that apply heat continuously to the patient here, because we've talked previously about how damaging hypothermia can be to these trauma patients and lead them down into the lethal triad of trauma.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about a little bit more about some of the abnormal physical findings that you can run up to, but I think we're going to tie that in with also some of the tests or adjuncts to the physical exam that we may be doing here in just a second.
One more special case. We talked throughout this podcast series about special populations, and so one of them clearly is pregnancy, something that I think is very useful that you can use to assess fetal age, right? The fundus. The top part of the uterus here. If you feel it, palpate it at or above the level of the umbilicus, that corresponds to a fetal age of 20 weeks or above. And that's generally regarded by OB as kind of the age of viability here. So if someone is pregnant, but you can't palpate the fundus or the very early along, then unfortunately, even with aggressive management, it won't necessarily change viability or poor prognosis of the baby there. We really have to be a little more sensitive. There is more potential of variability of outcome, let's just say, when a baby is at that age of viability here and what can happen there. So I think it's a good thing to note as far as where that fundus is.
All right, so let's move on to some of the adjuncts to the physical exam. And one of the big ones that has gained a lot of popularity and is very helpful is the EFAS or FAS exam. Now, the EFAS is the extended focused assessment of sonography and trauma. And the extended part is because you're looking at the chest, which we talked about with the thoracic section. With the rest of the FAS exam, what you're looking at is the cardiac windows, usually either doing a subxiphoid or, if need be, a parasternal long axis views, often the alternative option, but traditionally taught as a subxiphoid view. And you're looking for a pericardial effusion there. But then you're looking at the abdomen. You look at the right upper quadrant, the left upper quadrant, and you're looking at the suprapubic area. And you're looking for free fluid in those spaces. I'm not going to tell you how to do the EFAS exam here because we have separate podcasts to talk about that. And there's tons of courses out there that go over this material. But what I would mention is just that the EFAS exam, what you're looking for in the abdominal portion and the pelvic portion, is looking for free fluid, which looks black and pointy. It doesn't look like it's inside of a structure. One of the challenging things that can come up and one of the limitations is that there may not be enough free fluid present to actually be positive yet. And there are a couple of different reasons why. One of them is that if someone is sitting more in an upright position initially and you start looking at the right upper quadrant, you may miss the fluid that was developing in the pelvis, and then vice versa. If you have someone who's been laying supine for a long period of time, you want to check that right upper quadrant first because it's more likely to have free fluid there. But you may just simply not have enough blood present, and you can sometimes miss it early on, which is why serial exams are important. But also, if the patient has emptied their bladder recently, or you stuck in a Foley catheter prior to thinking about the need for an EFAS exam, if that bladder is decompressed, you lose your acoustic window there. And so it's much easier to miss a pelvic injury unless there's just a ton of free fluid present.
With regards to not doing a FAST, I think this is really powerful. From the text, the only contraindication to these studies, and these studies being a diagnostic peritoneal lavage, the DPL, or the FAST, is an existing indication for laparotomy. Meaning, if you already know this patient's going to surgery, then don't do a DPL, don't do a FAST, because those things are designed for you to know, hey, does this patient with soft vital signs or penetrating abdominal trauma, does this person need to go or not? If you already know they need to go, don't waste time with the DPL and the FAST. Spend your time in getting that patient to the operating room and doing other things like your massive transfusion protocol and other stuff like that.
I only have one issue with that. I'm fine with the DPL because the DPL is really just looking at the abdomen, but the EFAS exam is looking at the chest and the heart as well. So I would argue that I still think it is worth doing the EFAS exam, even if the patient already has an indication for laparotomy, because you could potentially miss important injuries in the chest.
No, that's brilliant. I think that's a great modification what they have here because they're talking more fast. And so they are kind of avoiding the E portion here, I believe. So yeah, that's brilliant. We talked about how, you know, if you have wounds from the chin to the umbilicus, you could have thoracic trauma. So that's brilliant. I like that a lot, that little modification there that, hey, do it, but you're doing it more to look for thoracic trauma.
One other thing with the EFAS before we move past it is that you have to keep in mind that there are false negatives. Sometimes there are also false positives because you can mistake certain structures. But false negatives, a lot of times obesity can really play a role here because it can be hard to either get the windows in the first place or it has a certain degradation to the images themselves. But also, it's not sensitive for hollow viscous injuries. And what we're going to find out really is that with any of these hollow viscous injuries can be missed. So we don't want to say, hey, there's absolutely nothing wrong, because there are sometimes things that are going on that just our routine tests aren't going to necessarily pick up. But here's the thing that I would like to talk about for a second is, what the hell is a DPL? Because a lot of people aren't going to actually know what a DPL is. So Mike, as the older PA here, have you ever seen a DPL be used?
Frankly, not. You know, I've worked at places where we have surgeons really readily available. And so, no, I've not been in a position where we've had to actually do that.
I've been trained in how to do it, but I've never had to do it. So really quickly, what a DPL is, it is a diagnostic peritoneal lavage. So essentially, you are putting fluid in, then pulling it back out and see if there's anything in it. And if you were to aspirate gastrointestinal contents, vegetable fibers, or bile, we know that it should not just be in the abdominal cavity and that that's bad. And if you were to aspirate 10 cc's or more of blood in a hemodynamically unstable patient, that would also be an indication towards laparotomy. So it's really not being used that much anymore because we're usually going to CT and or performing the EFAS exam. But DPL is still out there and is done in those situations where CT or the EFAS exam is not available.
Yeah, and I think there's, with how kidney injury from IV contrast is becoming less of a thing nowadays, I think it's also become more common to, look, let's just go ahead and take this person to CT within minutes of his arrival, assuming he's, of course, hemodynamically stable, because, you know, radiology is where patients go to die, as we've all heard before, right? So we want to make sure we're sending that patient to CT and he is hemodynamically stable. So if that's the case here, and we have a high enough index of suspicion here, hey, look, it's a young person with no big medical complaints here. Yeah, he's probably going to take the dye just fine. Go ahead and send him off to CT. Let's not wait an hour, hour and a half for our creatinine to come back. So yeah, in these situations here, you know, you can get CTs back so quickly, especially when the radiology team and everyone is kind of on board with rapidly interpreting these images.
And seriously, if you're truly worried about it, as one medical director told me, and I'm going to slightly modify it so it's less heavy on the language, but screw the kidneys, because if they're dead, the kidneys don't matter anyway. But you know, you can always dialyze someone if you have to. You can always do things otherwise if you really get in that situation. But realistically, as Mike has alluded to, we're finding out more and more that contrast is less of a concern. But what is a concern is that people anchor on the CT as being the all-knowing donut of truth when, like Mike says, it can be the donut of death, but also it doesn't catch everything. You can miss certain types of gastrointestinal, diaphragmatic, and pancreatic injuries. And so if there is an absence of hepatic or splenic injuries that's seen on CT, but there's still free fluid, that should be highly suggestive that there's something else going on there. And that usually that is going to be another indication for laparotomy. But even if that's missing, don't think, okay, that's completely normal. And every patient who ever has that, even if they're still in severe pain, is fine to go home and they just need to suck it up.
There are a few more adjuncts I want to talk about before we move on to specific injuries here. It's things like urethrography, cystography, an IV pyelo, oral contrast that is here. So just know that depending on what exactly you're worried about here, like if we're worried about a ureteral injury, we're worried about a urethral injury, we're worried about some sort of ruptured peritoneal and kidney injury here, there are special studies that you would get above and beyond just hitting your CT abdomen and pelvis with IV contrast button in your EMR. So, do take care to read your ATOS manual about when those things are indicated. One big one is if you're seeing blood in the urethral meatus, you have to be worried about some sort of upstream trauma to the urinary and renal system here. And so those are good reasons to do those special kinds of things to highlight injuries to the urinary system.
I want to include the red text here because I find it very important. The absence of hematuria does not exclude an injury to the tract. A retrograde urethrogram is mandatory when the patient is unable to void, requires a pelvic binder, or has blood at the meatus, scrotal hematoma, or perineal ecchymosis. To reduce the risk of increasing the complexity of a urethral injury, confirm an attacked urethra before inserting a urinary catheter.
It's so funny how that's kind of like the complete opposite of a patient that's coming in who has fever of unknown origin and sepsis. You're like, well, I need to figure out what's going on in the urinary bladder. Hey, if he doesn't pee in an hour, go ahead and cath that patient. In the trauma patient, you're actually saying, hey, if he's not peeing, we have to make sure that that whole system is intact here. So don't just go ahead and cath if can't void, as it says in my electronic medical system.
Let's talk a little more about some specific cases here. One of the things we didn't necessarily talk about before with penetrating trauma is that most abdominal gunshot wounds are managed by exploratory laparotomy because the incidence of significant intraperitoneal injury approaches 98% when peritoneal penetration is present. So basically, if it gets outside of the subcutaneous layers and fascia, once it gets into the peritoneal cavity, probably something's all jacked up inside.
We talked about cavitation, all that stuff. So just because, it kind of looks okay, doesn't mean there aren't some hidden things that aren't going on there that an XLAP will see. You can visualize those things.
And talking about anterior abdominal wounds, while a positive EFAS exam can be really helpful in this situation, a negative does not exclude some sort of visceral injury going on. And something that was mentioned by Mike kind of in passing, but he mentioned double and triple contrast studies. You may think to yourself, what is that? Like, what does that actually mean? Well, traditionally, a double would be IV plus PO contrast, and then triple is for that unfortunate person, PO, IV, and rectal contrast, which has a similarly high accuracy and is faster than just performing serial abdominal exams. But performing PO and rectal contrast is just not something we're commonly seeing these days.
No, I agree. It's definitely unorthodox, and maybe it's something you'd consider when maybe you had just high volume and you needed a little bit of more of a faster throughput than just kind of sitting and walking the patient. Maybe there was some sort of a viral pandemic going on and you had a lot of beds filled. You couldn't, just watch this patient because we had a lot of beds occupied already. So that might be one situation where you might go with this more aggressive tactic.
Hashtag COVID-19.
No kidding, right?
All right. So another thing to think about here are pancreatic injuries. Now, this is red text, kind of interesting. An early normal serum amylase level does not exclude major pancreatic trauma. Conversely, the amylase level can be elevated from non-pancreatic sources. My question is, okay, it mentions amylase, but what about lipase?
I think it's just like in the medical world here is that we know that lipase is the money. We know that's way more specific for pancreatic injury, lipase, than amylase. My kind of flipped question to you is, Chip, is like, do you know of in the emergency medicine realm, is there a time where serum amylase is actually useful?
This is when I want to pull out a Procrates and actually see with my amylase test if anything is actually outside the reference range that would matter. But I can't really think of cases where the amylase is going to be positive, but the lipase is not. I mean, can you?
No, I mean, I'm thinking about when would amylase crack the case? You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, if only you'd ordered an amylase, we would have saved that patient's life.
If only someone had done it.
Yeah. I just can't think of a situation,
I'm looking through Hippocrates because I really like using this and I get no money from Hippocrates, but I use this sometimes with labs and I'm trying to build a differential based on a certain lab.
Yeah.
I'm not seeing anything here that is going to help me versus when Lipase is going to help me. So if you're listening to this and you have a reason why we are so wrong and why we need to order amylase every time, please, by all means, tell me and share that, and also tell Mike how horribly wrong he is.
I'm okay with that. Yeah.
But otherwise, I mean, I can't think of a time where amylase is going to be that much helpful in this kind of context, where again, the lipase is not going to be elevated, which is why I think we're ordering less and less frequently the amylase, and we're trying to think about something else in our differential too.
I'm pretty sure I've literally never ordered an amylase in 10 years of my life practicing medicine, but I did just find something. Okay, so WikiM, again, I don't get paid by WikiM either. So, and this is like 100% pertinent what we're talking about here. So assessing peritoneal fluid. Okay, so you'd get your standard, you know, like cell counts and cultures and whatever else here, but you could also consider checking an amylase with peritoneal fluid. Now, would that be in trauma or more like paracentesis from ascites?
I would think that'd be more paracentesis.
Yeah. All right. Maybe there's just zero functionality of amylase in trauma. Are we zero so hard? We'll say 1% and it's unknown. How about that? We'll throw amylase a bone there. I can't think of it though.
It is most likely unlikely to help. I will tell you that when I order my trauma set and I include abdominal studies, I will get a lipase, but I have not been ordering amylase.
I think a lipase is fair.
I'm always open to new concepts and ideas. So if there's some reason why, again, please let us know, because I'd be happy to put some kind of a addendum or amendment that shows that, hey, we were corrected.
We need to do one of those like memes. You know that one meme where it's like the boyfriend looking back at like the one attractive girl, and the other girl is like, "What are you doing?" And so like the "What are you doing?" girl is like, "Be like the amylase," and the one over walking away with the lipase. I think that'd be a good meme.
I think I can add that to the show notes. All right, back on track. We've already like hit the head on the holoviscus injuries quite a bit, but I'm going to put in another red text thing. Although some patients have early abdominal pain and tenderness, the diagnosis of holoviscus injuries can be difficult since they are not always associated with hemorrhage. I know we've already said this like three different ways, but I think it's worth hitting it again, because this is the thing, I don't know about you, Mike, this is the thing I worry about most, is missing a holoviscus injury in abdominal trauma.
Yeah, I mean, the slow leak of gastric or intestinal contents into the belly, that's eventually going to kill someone from sepsis. And you may not see that on a CT scan. You may not see that on an EFAST exam here. I think that the money is always going to be these serial abdominal exams. That's so critical to a patient who has this concerning mechanism here. And then also, you know, you're doing these exams, you're documenting in your medical record, I did exams at this time, at this time, at this time, and there were still no peritoneal signs. And then if I discharge them, I'm giving them clear follow-up instructions. Hey, how are you going to follow up? Do you have a family doctor? You don't. Okay, well, look, I'm going to give you this other place you can go without medical insurance. Go get a re-examination there. If you cannot, I need you to come back to the ER and we can re-examine you here. Just really, when you've got a mechanism that is so associated with potential badness on the road here, I think it's really important that you drill down, okay, how, not just where, but can the patient really follow up the way I want them to, or is this not going to happen the way we think it's going to happen?
I do have good news for you though, Mike.
Okay.
This is another red text thing. Concomitant holoviscus injury occurs in less than 5% of patients initially diagnosed with isolated solid organ injuries. So if you are able to identify like that localized isolated solid organ injury, then you're probably going to be safe from the holoviscus injury, but a 1 in 20 chance is still not great. So fortunately, most of these people are going to be admitted to the hospital for a period of time anyway for some further observation, which helps us at least in the ED side of things.
Yeah, I mean, those folks can get serial abdominal exams over the course of 24 to 48 hours. And so that's going to be pretty good for them.
So something we have ignored here, basically, up to this point, as we are wrapping up this podcast, are pelvic fractures. And so there are more than one type, of course. We have lateral compression, and we have AP compression, that's your open book. And then we had the vertical shear fracture at the SI joint and pubic symphysis. But the one that we think about where we're going to put that pelvic binder, and this is so, so important, is we don't use a pelvic binder on every single pelvic fracture. And this is something that I think ATLS 10th edition did a better job at emphasizing than in the previous edition. So it's something I can really appreciate them taking the time to point out. But really, it's open book pelvic fractures, which are usually going to be that AP compression. So think about like your head-on accidents. And the idea there is to close that book back up. And so you do this by binding the pelvis. And traditionally, this is thought of with a sheet, but there are commercial devices that are honestly much easier to use because sometimes the sheets can be a bit of a pain. But the idea is that you're supposed to let these rest over the greater trochanters. A lot of times people put this way too high up and they end up putting it more on like the iliac crest or like the iliac wings. And it really doesn't do anything beneficial. So you go low down, like right over where you can feel the hips and that greater trochanter, and you're binding over that spot, and you want it to be tight. Because what you're trying to do is trying to help, again, close that book up and help stabilize the pelvis. And when you do that, you're able to help tamponade that blood to a certain degree. But something that some people will do, and I hate it, is that they'll rock the pelvis first. And don't do that. Don't do that. Because all you're doing is you're breaking up clots, you're promoting bleeding. So if you're going to do a traditional physical exam, then what is probably better off is to do a simple push from anterior posterior on that patient's pelvis, and you'll still be able to feel the separation when it's there. What I like even more is I look at it with ultrasound because I'm not having to push on anything then. And diagnostically, an open book pelvic fracture is seen the same by ultrasound or by x-ray, which is greater than a 25 millimeter separation at the pubic symphysis. So if you see that on an x-ray or by ultrasound, then that is pretty much diagnostic with an open book pelvic fracture. But I'd still probably get the x-ray as soon as possible to help make sure that there's not other types of fractures going on. And in a trauma situation where they're in severe shape, if I'm at all concerned about pelvic trauma, I'm going to go ahead and empirically bind the pelvis. I'm not going to wait for ultrasound if I don't have it readily available, or for x-rays, which can sometimes take a longer time. That pelvis needs to be bound as quickly as possible.
Yeah, if you've got someone with the right mechanism of injury for this kind of AP front to back compression of the pelvis and their vital signs are soft, yeah, I don't think you're going to do a lot of harm by throwing a binder over the pelvis. And yeah, I totally agree. It's got to put it in the right place. If you put it too high, you might be actually torquing, the symphysis pubis open a little bit more and like keeping it open. So yeah, you got to put it on the right place there. Some other kinds of fracture, lateral compression injury. So that's the most common kind of fracture. That's from kind of a side impact. So a side to side, left to right force here. Most common with, someone falling on their side and breaking the hip that way. Less associated with life-threatening hemorrhage, but there's still plenty of morbidity that can come from hemorrhage there, also from bladder or urethral injury too. Another kind of hip fracture, pelvic fracture, is your vertical shear fracture. And so that's going to come from a top-down, up and down through the pelvis injury. So someone who falls from a great height, 12 feet or so, they can have this fracture at the SI joint here. It's so important, by the way. We're talking about, imaging. And if you do an ultrasound, of course, you're reading those images as you're obtaining them here. But if you order that x-ray of the pelvis here, it's important you go ahead and read it, okay? And I know that's kind of a basic medicine thing here, but sometimes it's the basics that we kind of overlook. Things like, percussion, the basics of medicine that we kind of miss in favor of the more sexy things, or we just get too busy, and that's how patients' problems get missed. So I want to really encourage you from things I've seen in past patients here, it's important that you personally look at those x-rays you order. Just take a second so you can make sure that you're not missing something as well that maybe somebody else who was supposed to interpret the x-ray properly also missed. I want to share one story here. One of the most graphic cases I had back in Afghanistan, we had these large convoys of military vehicles that would roll throughout the country here, often with armored heavy vehicles, tankers and supply trucks and stuff like that. And for whatever reason, there was just zero respect for these things. I mean, like, if I'm driving down the highway like 35 here in Dallas and I see a big truck, I'm going to give it the right of way. But people would, you know, have no problem cutting off these big tanker trucks or driving in between the convoys. And I'll never forget, you know, one of the earliest patients we had was a motorbike who cut in front of, like, he chose the biggest truck in our convoy, cut in front of it, lost his footing, so to speak, on his bike. And that tanker truck rolled over him. And I still recall my poor medic, you know, had worked this guy hard as they drove him back to the base here. And he's like, I don't understand. This guy is not responding to what we're doing. And we exposed him and he had this massive scrotal hematoma. And so that is one of the things, if you see, you know, the right kind of mechanism, or you hear the right kind of mechanism, and you're seeing scrotal hematoma or other kinds of hematoma in the perineal area here, super, super concerning for exsanguinating hemorrhage in the pelvis here. That guy had for sure crepitus when you compress the spines, and you know, he did not make it. And so that was one of those things where I'll never forget that sensation of, you know, pushing on the spines and going, oh, that's what that feels like. That's what I've heard about before. So that was a real nasty case, but it was really illustrative of, wow, you know, that can generate this big scrotal perineal hematoma from this open book fracture and all the blood that can be lost in that space.
As we're wrapping up here, I will just quickly mention that, like, embolization is often being used for abdominal trauma. And so a lot of times your interventional radiology and trauma surgery teams are working together to help manage these patients. But we're also finding out that RBOA, which is rapid endovascular balloon occlusion of the aorta, is becoming more and more of a thing and getting started in the emergency department versus getting always started by surgery. And of course, we've talked about tranexamic acid or TXA in the past, but really all these additional things are things that are more adjuncts and kind of things that we're not necessarily going to be dictating on the emergency department side, but it's still worth knowing.
I'm kind of surprised they didn't talk about RBOA in this chapter.
Yeah, I think it's still kind of one of those relatively newer things that maybe it just didn't make it in time for it to be edited into the 10th edition. I'm not sure, because it's kind of one of those things that it's really gaining a lot of ground, but I think we'll have to see.
11th edition, perhaps.
Yeah. So, Mike, I think that pretty well wraps us up. This has been about an hour long, which seems to be our pretty normal thing, especially with these really dense, very topical chapters where we have to cover a lot of information. I think we did really well.
Yeah, I agree. Just to sum up here, one big decision point early is your hemodynamic stability of the patient. If you see someone who's hemodynamically unstable from the jump, don't spend your time necessarily doing a lot of time-intensive diagnostic studies here. An EFAST, very quick. And like Chip mentioned, you can see some thoracic trauma with the EFAST. So still a value in doing the EFAST exam, even though someone has soft vital signs here. But know that your treatment here is getting them to the OR as fast as possible here. If you have people that are more stable hemodynamically here and their mechanism is less concerning, where they need clearly immediate laparotomy here, that's when you have time to order your various adjuncts to the physical exam. Go ahead and do that good physical exam. Maybe you pass the auscultation, but I think that looking for signs of peritonitis is very useful, not just in the medical setting, but the trauma setting as well. And understand that there's a lot of places where blood and contents of viscous organs can hide out. So just because you got a clean looking EFAST, just because you got a clean looking CT scan, that doesn't mean there aren't insidiously developing things going on. Your serial abdominal exams, your observation of these patients with bad mechanisms can be the key to saving that person's life.
All right. Well, Mike, great job wrapping that all up. Can you go ahead and give us the tagline?
I will. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.